Accession number 4510, Reel 2.
Canal Grove, Reel 2. Earlier you were talking about the apprehending of suspects. How did you identify them?
Well, immediately he was surrounded the village, assuming he didn't find anybody armed, in which case he'd have either been shot or whipped in anyway. You collected all the men and put them in a pen. You then had interpreters, police, intelligence people, and so on, who screened all these people, and presumably they had with them a set of photographs and this, that, and the other, and asked them usual police questions, where were you last night, and all that sort of thing. And it was really up to the police, that side of things. And they used to find known criminals, you know, and that sort of thing. They had records of them all and so on, and they were taken away to a police detention place and interrogated again, and if they were found they'd made a mistake, well, they let go.
What was the morale of the British troops in Palestine?
Very high, I'd say. Very high indeed. Excellent.
Why do you think that was?
Well, it's a marvellous climate to start with. It's a beautiful country. I don't know if you've been there, but in the spring it's absolutely out of this world and that sort of thing. They got nice barracks. They used to go out on detachment away from the regimental sergeant major and this, that and the other, which they enjoyed. And I think all of us used to get a little bit extra pay too, which was quite a good thing. And of course, while you were operating or on detachment, you couldn't spend any money or anything. So if they came back to barracks, they got a bit of money to enjoy themselves with.
What did the going out on detachment involve?
Well, you had such things as platoon detachments. I was in a old Crusader fort in a place called Shaffer Armour, and I was told there'd been trouble there, so we'd got to have a detachment there, completely on your own with your platoon. And the place was put under curfew, and it was up to you to patrol the place and see that they didn't break the curfew and this, that and the other. But that's about all. And also, of course, to improve the comforts and defense of your wherever you were. Now, another time I was on a company one, and this time we just requisitioned a certain number of houses in the village. There were powers of requisition, so you hoofed the unfortunate people out and settled in there. And the company ones, we did rather longer patrols. I mean, the same idea, enforce the curfew and so on. But we used to go and poke around in neighbouring villages and things and see if there was anything doing. Or if there was any problem that was known, we'd go after it, you know, follow it up, see what it was all about.
How strict were the local inhabitants about keeping the curfew?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, if we were there, we could tell how strict, and they were pretty well kept if we were there. But if we weren't there, I don't know, and there was still a curfew, I don't know how strict they'd have been then.
So you didn't come across instances whilst you were patrolling of people wandering out of houses with pretext?
No, they kept pretty well in.
What was the demeanour of the people from whom you evicted from the houses?
Well, Honestly, I don't know. I never met them. Never came across them. It was all been done just before, you know, usually taking over from somebody or something. And I don't know. I think a bit sour.
When the troops were on detachment, were the posts ever raided?
To the best of my knowledge, no. When I was with Wingate, well, they weren't army posts, they were Jewish detachments, you know, settlements. And they were. But I don't think I can remember any of our detachments actually being attacked. Some other regiments were, I know. But I don't think ours was.
What about the equipment that you had to do the job? Did you find that adequate?
Yes. For the opposition we had, yes, it was quite adequate. We'd a few Lewis guns, a mortar platoon, otherwise it was all rifles. We didn't have any automatic rifles or Sten guns or anything like that. We would have done a bit better if we had, I think. Certainly when I was with Wingate, if we'd had a few automatics then, we would have knocked off a lot more than we did.
Did you find the clothing and footwear of the troops adequate for the job they were doing?
Well, we adapted it. We got there in the winter, you see, in January, and we started off in full winter clothing and found it impossible. It was altogether too heavy and too this, that and the other. So in my battalion, and I think most of the others, we always operated after a very short time in canvas clothing, what we called denims in the last war, you know what I mean? And PT shoes, which would get around much better. Because it's terribly rocky in the hills there, and if you wore boots, you kept skidding off these rocks. So everybody found PT shoes, you'd get along much better. And as I say, just canvas. And a minimum of equipment, really. Just your rifle and a water bottle and something to put the ammunition in.
Did you ever feel apprehensive when you were operating against the Arabs? Mm. Or did you feel that it was more like a game?
Well, I don't think I did, really. It's more like a sort of country walk, rather a long, tedious one, thinking nothing would ever happen, which 9 times out of 10 nothing did. And the 10th time, you stumbled on something and you got so excited about it that you really rather enjoyed it, I regret to say. Once or twice with Wingate, it was a bit frightening because we only worked in the night. You know, you're never quite sure what was what. So we got a bit apprehensive then. But, no, I think when the battalion came, I remember one operation, we came across quite a lot of, about 50 or 60 or something. And I was mortar officer, so I was well at the back and able to watch the whole of the battalion. And on the football grounds at Shorncliffe, where we used to practice these manoeuvres and things, I always used to think, oh, this is rather a lot of rubbish. And I watched a company put in an attack, which was completely successful. They did exactly what we did on the football grounds, and I thought, my goodness, it works. Which was interesting. And I think the soldiers were pleasantly surprised, because I think they thought, oh, this is a lot of rubbish, really. And quite surprised, too, when they found it worked.
How did the troops react when the occasional casualty was taken?
Oh, very philosophically. Nobody blew a gasket or anything in there. Poor old Charlie and that sort of thing.
You said that you were stationed on arrival at Peninsula Camp,
mm-hmm.
and that you're on outpost duty at Shaffer Armour.
Mm-hmm.
Did you operate anywhere else with the RWK in
Palestine? Oh, yes. Now, at one time, we had to... we had a platoon on the railway in armoured trucks, and they kept getting blown up. And then they decided this wasn't just enough. So they stopped the trains running until dawn. I think they stopped overnight trains altogether. And we were down... I can't remember the name of the place. But we had to patrol on foot about 15 miles or so of railway before the first train, roughly, I suppose, 2 or 3 hours before dawn, until dawn, when it used to appear. And very annoyed were they if we hadn't got to the end by then. And we never found anything. But nothing happened while we were doing it, so it must have done some good. And I can assure you, there's nothing more mesmerizing than walking along a railway line. I don't know if you've done it for far, but after about 10 miles, you're going like this all the time.
Kind of hypnotic.
Yeah.
Whereabouts was this section of track?
Well, I think it was going south. It was about 20 miles south of Haifa to about 30 miles south of Haifa.
You said that you were seconded for about 6 months to the Special Night Squad,
mm-hmm.
Under Wingate. Mm. How did this come about?
Well, I think Wingate had done a lot of hard work trying to track down smugglers as much as anything else coming across from Syria, and a certain amount of armed bands too. So he put forward a suggestion that he should be allowed to form a private sort of army only to operate at night, because at night the Arabs reckoned they were free to do what they liked. And to a certain extent they were, because it was virtually impossible to operate a battalion at night except for one set thing. But wandering about over these hills at night was not on, really, for a battalion. So he asked if he could form these small squads and place them along the frontier and patrol from there and so on, and he was granted permission. And General Evetts, or Brigadier Evetts as he was then, sent round to all the battalions in his brigade asking for one officer and 10 other ranks from each battalion. And in my battalion, I think all the subalterns put down for it. And I at the time was mortar officer, really, and a bit of a spare file, because my platoon was usually out one section with a detachment here and there. Well, I couldn't be with them all, so I wasn't anywhere. And so I suppose he picked on me. And then told me I could choose a sergeant, a corporal, and 10 men. Yes.
How did you make the choice?
Oh, well, I knew a certain man's car. I was captain of football, and I knew most of the football team would come. So I did it like that, really. And they were all pretty fit. I knew it was going to be an awful lot of hard work. And they were pretty tough chaps, so I chose them.
So it was a question of you, and you, was it?
Oh, no, not in the least, no. No, they said they'd come. There were no regimental sergeant major again, you see, and none of that stuff. Completely on our own. So they lapped it up.
They were quite willing to volunteer.
Yeah, and they got a bit of extra pay, too.
Can you tell me next about your time with the Special Night Squad and how you operated?
Mm-hmm. Well, to begin with, we were patrolling the pipeline. And we used to do this by sort of zigzagging, hit the pipeline, go along a bit, and then come out, and then hit it again somewhere else. And occasionally we found somebody, and occasionally we didn't. Usually, what happened was the Arabs were fairly bright about. They would somehow spot you, go by, and then light it up where you'd just been, you know, which was intensely annoying. But there was a big wire fence called Tegut's Wall right along the whole of the frontier. And they used to put a hook over this wire and then tear it down with a whole team of camels and then just walk through and blow the pipeline up and burn it away, you know, merrily. But then, almost immediately I got there, Winky got some information about a raid somewhere. And we went out and had quite a battle on the Syrian frontier at some village or other, I've forgotten what. And that shooed them off, all right, for quite a long time.
Can you describe the battle?
Well, I don't know. We just sort of surrounded a village and sent a squad in. And they all came running out. And so we got them. No casualties to us, a few to them, I think. And then after we were on the pipeline, we redeployed a little bit, and Wingett used to get information, I don't know where he got it from, and used to send us out, three of us in a row, he had three squads, about a couple of miles or 3 miles apart. He'd get some information that somebody was in such and such an area, and we would do a sort of sweep. And find something or not, because they were quite careless at the beginning anyway, because they reckoned they could function at night and we couldn't, you see. Well, to give you an example, one night, I don't know where he got the information about, this was the night that I told you about these horsemen. And I suppose I had to walk about 20 miles. What he used to do was to put us in trucks and drive virtually in the opposite direction from where we were going, and in a bit of a circle. And then we would drop off the trucks, which were in bottom gear and creeping along in the dark, and never stopping, and then march back again where we'd gone to, more or less. And I had about 10 to 15 miles, I suppose, over mountainous country, and I worked out from the map that this was about the 13th wadi along my route. Well, the maps, I suppose, were fairly good, but in the dark, it's awfully difficult to tell what counts as a wadi and what doesn't, because you're doing this sort of thing the whole time.
Up and down.
Anyway, I got to what I thought was it, we used to go by the stars and by time, you know, you reckoned so much of many hours, miles to the hour and so on. And I reckon, well, this is probably it. And so we got into position, and then I said, just about dawn, to our amazement, coming straight at this warrior was this party of horsemen. But how I ever found it, or even if I did find the right one and they got the wrong one or something, I never discovered. And how he discovered that they were going to be there, I just no idea. Another time I was laying in ambush, and I was told that somebody was going to come along a track, and he'd be preceded by two men, and then would follow himself with two donkeys. Well, one man came along, so we let him go, and then one donkey came along, we let him go, and then of course nothing else happened. So whether I let them go or not, I don't know.
The horseman you said that you shot on this particular occasion, what type of arms did you find they were equipped with?
Oh, very old rifles.
British?
No. Gosh, I can't remember now. They were all pretty ropey old things anyway, whatever they were. Yeah, I think a lot of them were German Mausers and things like that. I think. Or Turkish. A lot of them might have been Turkish. And a lot of them, I think, were homemade. They were quite dab hands at this, apparently. But nothing modern.
When you went out on one of the night patrols, what kind of clothing and footwear would you have?
Not strictly orthodox at all, I'm afraid. Well, usually the lightest we could get. We usually didn't wear shorts because it was so prickly and scratchy, so they just wore slacks. Wingate got some very good hockey boots, which were made by Barter, I think, somewhere. And they were good because they had sort of ankle pads, which you hit the rocks an awful lot, and your ankles used to get chipped to blazes, and this helped a lot. And a bandolier, and a gun, that was it. And a water bottle, always took a water bottle.
Food?
No, we didn't take any food because none of his operations were planned except for that night. And none of them, in fact, did last more than that night. In my battalion, once we ran out of food, something led to something else and led to something else, and we were out about three or four nights on the move, and the trucks couldn't get to us, and we hadn't got any food. But that only lasted about a day, so it didn't matter much.
Did you just go without?
Yeah.
How often would you go out?
With Wingate? Well, we used to work on a fortnightly thing, and we used to get 4 days off every fortnight, so it was 10 days on. And out of those 10 days, we were probably out seven times, eight times maybe.
Was this exhausting work?
I can assure it was. Very exhausting. But the troops were very fit, and they managed to struggle along all right.
Did you go blacked up?
No. You mean black your faces? Yes. And things? No, we didn't.
How did the other British officers view the night squads?
With the gravest suspicion.
Why was that?
I don't know, that might have been jealousy. We did rather better than they did. Thanks to the genius of Wingate, I think, really. How he got all this information and so on. See, none of it used to go through the normal channels. I don't know where it came from. But he was so often successful. And if you have got a reasonable bunch of chaps, which we all had, and you stumbled on something, you were more or less bound to win, because they never thought you'd be there, never thought anyone would be there.
What contact did the squads have with the Jewish population?
Wingate had contact from the top downwards, from Wiseman or whoever he was, who was the head Jew, to the heads of all the settlements. They all knew Wingate. And ourselves, very, very friendly with the people we lived with. And indeed, some Jews worked with us. I had one absolutely splendid chap who came with me always, and as a guide as much as anything. He knew the country well, you know. Well, I could say, where the hell are we now? Do you think? I think we're here. And he said, well, I think that's such and such a village, so if we keep on like that, should be all right. And after the war, or a few 10 years ago, I was rung up and told that this chap was a ploughman, but he operated with me. And I was told that General Avram Joffe would be very pleased if I go and have lunch with him in London. And he'd become a general in the Jewish wars after the war, you know, after the independence. Trained by me.
How did you set about training people like this chap?
Oh, well, Wingate taught us what to do. Not that we didn't devise our own methods. He couldn't see us in the dark anyway. And, well, this chap, I had one or two about as good as him, and they very quickly cottoned on. I think we had Moshe Dayan at one time with one of the squads, I'm not sure which. He became the top general.
Were they very raw as soldierly material?
No. You see, for years there had been, we'd known of its existence, but we hadn't been able to do much about it because they hid themselves up so well. There was a sort of illegal army called Hagana, which used to train them. And so they'd all had a certain amount of military training.
So did they not require very much further training from
them? No, I don't think so. Any tiny, stupid little things like, well, we always used to keep dead quiet at night. They were a bit apt to chat away and that sort of thing. You know, had to thump them a bit then. But other than that, they were quite okay.
Did you ever feel after the war that this training which you had given the Jews was being used against you?
Oh, without any doubt at all, yes. For instance, I went with Colonel Breeden, as he was then, to see some of the settlements we used to live in. And I went to one that I lived in and asked after this chap who I met in England. And they said, oh, it was very sad. He and his wife were both killed in a motorbike accident. Very sad. I had dinner with him after the war. Oh, yes, I shudder to think what they used to get up to.